नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So this request for the Dhamma talk, request for Dhamma reflections, and also the chant I just did, those are traditional chants that are done before a teaching. And the request, the Dhamma talk request, the Brahmacha Loka Dipati Sahampati, that's the story of the Brahma god Sahampati coming down and requesting that the Buddha turn the wheel of the Dhamma. Because when the Buddha first attained to the Dhamma under the Bodhi tree, 2,567 years ago or so, then he was inclined to not teach. And when he reflected on how could anybody understand the subtlety and the profundity of this Dhamma that I've attained to, and he thought, his mind leaned and inclined towards not teaching, not revealing what he had realized, the end of suffering. And he thought people aren't ready for to stop suffering. So he inclined to not teaching. So the Brahma God, who was a non-returner, that's the third stage of enlightenment. He had become a non-returner under the previous Buddha, Buddha Kassapa, who lived a very, very, very long time ago. And because Brahma gods, the timeline is different. They can live for multiple aeons. And so people who attain the third stage of awakening, what we call Anagami, they go up to some super high heavenly realm and they hang out there for billions of years. And so he came down and thought, no, we need to request that the Dhamma wheel be turned. So that's the story. And then the Buddha, with his Buddha eye, which is also the eye of compassion, was able to look over the whole world and see if anybody could actually realize the Dhamma. And he saw that yes, people would be capable. There are people with little dust in their eyes that can understand, practice, and some will be able to realize the Dhamma as well. So it's traditional. We do that request in Pali to request a Dhamma talk. And then when I start the Dhamma talk or when Ajahns give a talk, they'll start with the Namo Tassa three times, which that Namo Tassa just means Namo Tassa Bhagavato, homage to the Blessed One, the perfectly enlightened one. That comes from another god named Saka, also known as Indra. And so Saka was the one who first said Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. And that occurred, I can't remember exactly when that occurred, but Saka is a stream enterer. Saka becomes a, so it shows that celestial beings can become stream enterers. That's the first level of awakening, the first level of enlightenment. So we have a third level of awakening, Brahma, requesting the Dhamma. We've got a first level of awakening, king of the devas, Saka. He's the king of the Tavatimsa devas, the heaven of the 33, doing the Namo Tassa. So there's this whole Buddhist cosmology, and that ends up being one of the anusatis, one of these recollections that is done regularly, is recollection of devas. So this was part of the Indian worldview. It was just taken for granted that there was all these different realms of existence, then there was transmigration happening, there was humans, rebirth, redeath, this whole cycle happening over and over and over again. So our worldview in the West is quite a bit different from that. We might not necessarily just believe these things from childhood. So in India at that time, from childhood, you would have, even before the Buddha was around, Saka was a character in people's minds. that Sakko was this real being who could appear to you if you were faithful enough and had enough devotion and your meditation was good enough, you could have visions of Sakka or of Indra or of Brahma, which would be considered higher. And so all these characters end up appearing in the Buddhist canon, in the suttas, and they appear all over the place. They appear way too much to just write it off as being metaphorical, or it's actually a huge part of the teachings. So it's pretty hard to ignore it. And so, but you know, we can't, most of us, myself included, can't see these things. So we take it on faith, but it's not a blind faith. It's not a blind faith because there are many things in the Buddhist canon that we can verify for ourselves. For example, generosity has good effects. Non-anger has good effects. All these practices that the Buddha recommends has these good results for us. So we can take it as a working hypothesis, but not to dismiss it outright, because dismissing it outright and saying, you know, these things definitely don't exist also would be just as preposterous as saying these things definitely exist. So we take it as a working hypothesis and try to not fall into a irrational disbelief in rebirth, in karma and rebirth. We take it all as a working hypothesis. Of course, the Buddha didn't ever say that you had to believe in these things. So this brings us back to our theme for the day, which is kindness and patience. And I spoke a little bit about kindness or metta this morning, so I can speak about patience now. Kanti. Kanti is the word. Khanti. Kanti comes up in the teaching known as the Ovadapatimokkha. Kanti paramang tapotitika, which means patience or patient endurance, is the ultimate incinerator of the defilements. It burns up the defilements. So patience in this sense, Kanti, is not just gritting our teeth and bearing it till something's over, but it's the ability to be with the unpleasant. So we're able to be with the unpleasant and we don't get overwhelmed by it. And it's something where the patient person who has deep and vast patience is always content, is always happy. The patient person has a quality known as pamoja, which is contentment, even delight in the present moment. And pamoja is a very necessary factor for meditation. Pamoja is the precursor to piti and sukha. So we need to have this sense of very deep commitment, contentment, well, commitment as well. We need commitment to being patient, but we also need this sense of contentment. And Kanti is one of the paramitas, one of the 10 paramitas that is said that the Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha Gotama, our present Buddha, cultivated over a vast number of aeons in the past. It's over billions of past lives, cultivating the 10 paramitas, and one of those is patience, Kanti Parami. And the most extreme teaching about patience is the simile of the saw, where the Buddha states that even if somebody was savagely sawing your limbs off with a saw, if you were to give rise to a thought of anger towards your assailant, you would not be practicing patience. You would not be practicing the teaching. So that's the most extreme. That's a very, very extreme example. And almost nobody would be able to do that. I don't think I'd be able to not get angry at somebody who was attacking me in such a savage and vicious way. Although I don't know unless it was actually to happen. But that, so there you see that patience also has a connotation of non-anger, hence its link with metta practice. So to be patient also means that we don't give in to anger. So the times when anger would normally arise, or when we would normally act on anger, so we might anger might arise, but we don't act on it. The practice of patience is to not act on anger. So we can define Kanti, we can define patience as not acting on anger. Even if it arises, we don't act on it. And so what do we do if we don't act on it? Do we repress it? We don't want to repress it because then it can grow and become more and it might burst out in some other way. So it's we don't act on it and we don't repress it. There is a third option. There is to know it. And that's where the quality of mindfulness comes in, when we actually know. We know anger. We know anger as it arises, as it passes away. So it might seem like there's only two options: act on it or repress it. But to know it is to fully acknowledge it, and to not trying to say it's not there. So we are fully acknowledging it. That's mindfulness. And then when we fully acknowledge anger, that's our practice. That's the Dhamma. So there's another sutta where the Buddha talks about how is the Dhamma apparent here and now. So we chant these different qualities of the Dhamma. And paccatang is, it's apparent here and now. Sanditiko Dhamma. So that's, the Buddha says, how is the Dhamma apparent here and now? And then he gives the example of a thought of anger arising. So he says, it's apparent here and now when a thought of anger arises and one knows a thought of anger has arisen, when a thought of anger ceases and one knows a thought of anger has ceased. That's how the Dhamma is apparent here and now. So he's saying anything that's arising, to be able to know what is arising and to be able to know for sure that that's what's arising. If we were to repress or be in denial about our anger, that's not what the Buddha's recommending. So he's not recommending to actually deny that it's there. I can't be angry. I've been practicing for 25 years. I can't be angry. So that would be denial. If a thought of anger arises in my mind and I say, I've been practicing for so long, I can't possibly have a thought of anger, then that's denial. So that's not correct. According to the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's teaching would say to know it, to know that it's there and acknowledge it, be present for it. And in that knowing of it, it does seem to pass away pretty quickly. But if we deny it or repress it, then it festers, then it doesn't pass away so quickly. So we have to be careful. So patience is the not acting on anger. That's how we define Kanti Parami, the ability to do that. And then we also, when we talk about patience, we talk about pleasant and unpleasant aspects of our practice. So there's things we like to do and there's things we don't like to do. And sometimes there might be something we like to do and it's not beneficial. So just because we like something doesn't mean it's helpful for us or beneficial. So we like certain things that are harmful to us or harmful to others. That's when the practice says we need to go against our likes. So that's patience. But there's other things that we like and they're not harmful. So that in that sense, the practice says, well, we can just do what we like in that sense. So if I like giving, that's good. And I like it, I can follow what I like. I like giving. So that's something I like and that's something that's helpful. So don't have to go against our likes if there's something like that. There's things we don't like and they're harmful. So that's not a problem because we're not going to do them anyway because we don't like them. So that's good. That's good if we don't like certain harmful things. But then there's things that we don't like to do that are helpful, such as meditate. And that's when we go against ourselves and we say, no, I'm going to get out on the meditation cushion. I'm going to get onto the walking meditation path, even though I don't like it, because it is going to be something that's helpful. And so, in that sense, we need to practice patience and actually go against ourselves because we don't like to do that particular activity. Or we could insert whatever we say we don't like, receiving feedback. We don't like receiving feedback for our faults, for things we may have done wrong. We don't like it, but it's actually very, very helpful because it's going to help us have better conduct in the future. It's going to help us to, in this path of purification of the mind in the future. So there's certain things we have our likes and dislikes, and there's things that are helpful and unhelpful. And so patience is really, its function is to cause us to more and more and more do what's going to be beneficial for ourselves and others and abandon what's going to be detrimental or harmful for ourselves and others. So that really takes patience. There's also the teaching about like temperament. People have different temperaments. There's greed types, there's anger types, there's thinking types, there's delusion types. So we all have all of these different temperaments, but one is generally usually going to be prominent. So for greed types like to do metta. And they don't like to do things like asubha or contemplating the unbeautiful nature of their own body and the bodies of others. It's a monastic practice that we do for cooling down the heart, cooling down thoughts of greed or lust. Greed types don't like to do that practice, but that's the one they need. That's the one that's going to be helpful for them. So they need patience to do that. Greed types will like to do metta. That's not going to be helpful for them. Anger types, they love asubha practice. They've got corpses and pictures of train wrecks in their kuti and gore. And but that's not what they need. They don't need that. They need metta. So they have to go against what they like and do what they don't like. Have to use. So everybody needs patience. So every character type needs this quality of Kanti, needs this quality of patience. Or sometimes we might be undergoing a certain practice, so say a long meditation retreat, and we start to wonder, is this really going to be of any benefit? This just seems really difficult. Why am I even doing this? Or keeping the precepts long term, why am I even doing this? Doesn't make sense. It just seems to be a needless difficulty. So to give it time, give it enough time to actually truly see the results of that practice. It's like walking on Tudong. We do this practice in the Thai forest tradition of Tudong. And this stems from the time of the Buddha where the monks don't actually need to live in monasteries. With our precepts, we can actually live anywhere. We can be dependent on alms food anywhere. If we walk through a village and receive bits of food from the villagers, then we can actually live anywhere. But when walking, say driving, you get places pretty quickly. But when you're walking, takes a while when you're walking. So if you want to walk from a Bayagiri, Redwood Valley, California, up to Pacific Hermitage, White Salmon, Washington, it's about 600 miles, and you're going to walk, it's going to take a while. You can drive in one day. You can drive it in 13 hours, 12 or 13 hours. But if you're going to walk, it's going to take a while. But driving, you don't need that much patience. You need a bit of patient endurance. It's a long drive. But if you're going to walk, then you can't really think about necessarily, if you get impatient, you're going to give up. You're not going to make it. Or like there's different ways to sew our robes. A lot of the monks sew their own robes in our tradition, and you have to sew your own robes if you're going to become if you're newly ordained. It's required that as a novice you sew your own set of robes. So whether you know how to sew or not, you will learn. And some people choose to do the hand sewing. So using a so you have that option to use a sewing machine, which would be like driving to Pacific Hermitage, or you can hand sew, which would be like walking. So when you're hand sewing, each stitch is like one little step. And when you're hand sewing a robe, if you think, "Oh, look how much left I've got to do, this is impossible," then you know that's going to be very difficult to finish it ever. But if you just don't focus, don't look at the big picture, but look at the small picture. Actually, look at just okay, just one stitch at a time, and it'll get done eventually. So that's a really good practice for developing patience. And a lot of the monks do sew their robes by hand now. They can see that that's a good practice. And a lot of the monks actually go Tudong fairly regularly now and can see that that's a good practice. And when you're just walking along the highway, if you really get into that mode of patience, then it's quite pleasant. Then you've got the Pamoja, the contentment coming up. But if thinking, I'm gonna have to walk this many miles this day, and I'm gonna have to walk this many miles the next day, and kind of thinking about the whole thing, then it's not gonna work so well. So patience. Patience is very, very important. And when Ajahn Chah was asked what were the qualities that he developed that caused him to ultimately succeed in his practice as a monk, he said there was two things. One was contemplation of impermanence. Two was patience, was being patient. And also, when a lot of the Westerners who would come to practice and train with Ajahn Chah would tend to be very, very impatient. So he kept telling them, "Look, you know, I'm not going to give you some special teaching. You just need to be patient." Or there's a story I heard one time of a Westerner wanting to ordain with one of these disciples of Ajahn Mun. I think it was maybe, I can't remember who it was, maybe Longpo Lui or Longpo Tait that he was wanting to ordain with. But he wanted to know how long it's going to take to get enlightened. So he went to this Ajahn and said, "I'd like to ordain, but how long is it going to take me to get enlightened?" And the Ajahn said, 10 years. And he said, "What? 10 years?" 20 years. "What? 20 years? How could that be? That's way too long." And he said, "For you, I think 30 years." So that patience is something we need, but it's also a result. We need patience. Patience, the paradox is that patience is gonna bring the results faster. And the more impatient we are, the slower the results are gonna be. And then when we start to get results, we're also gonna become more patient. So it's both the path and the result. So this is Tapo Kanti Paramang, Tapo Titika. Tapo is like tapas, that's spiritual fire that the Buddha criticizes it in most places, but in this case, he praises that quality. Tapas is the austerities, but he's saying Kanti, patience is a good austerity. That's an allowable austerity. And of course, as most of us know, the life of the Buddha, who did the Buddha as the Bodhisatta before he was enlightened, did extreme austerities. To the point that he said that the pain he was experiencing from those austerities was the most pain anybody could experience without actually dying. And he said, anybody who is experiencing pain in the world could only equal this, but not go beyond this to this level of pain. And he said, that's not the right path. So he's not talking about that type of tapas. That's what tapas was normally understood to be in India at that time, was the spiritual fire that you're doing austere practices and even self-torment, self-torture to the point where you can gain powers, psychic powers, visions of various kinds. So he said, that's not the right path. But he said, Kanti, the patient endurance is the tapas that you want to be practicing. It's the austerity that should be practiced by all practitioners. So Kanti Paramang. Paramang means the highest. Tapo is the spiritual fire. Titika, it is. It's the ultimate spiritual fire. And then he goes on to say in the Ovadapadimokkha, Nibbanang Paramang Vadanti Buddha, which is Nibbanang is Nibbana, or the cooling down of the mind, is the highest, say the Buddhas. Vadanti, that means they teach. Vadanti Buddha, so that's what the Buddhas teach, that Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika. It's a nice chant to learn. I think it's on page 81 of the chanting book. Maybe at the end of today we can chant it. Nibbanang Paramang Vadanti Buddha. Then after that, it's Nahi Pabbajito Para. Not us, not a one who's gone forth shouldn't bring harm to anybody. And one who speaks harshly to people is not a religious seeker. So he talks about just these basic conduct. I think it's the precursor that is the patience, because with that recollection of patience, that's what it takes to have good conduct, to not actually use harsh speech, to not do harm to anybody. That takes patience. And in that same teaching, it goes on to very basic things. And this is a teaching the Buddha gave to 1,250 arhats, fully enlightened beings. They didn't need any teachings anymore. But it's a distillation of the Dhamma. So the distillation of the Dhamma says moderation in food, moderation in sleep, getting away to a secluded dwelling place from time to time to look after one's practice. And that's it. That's the teaching of the Buddha. So patience with these very practical things, patience, virtue, moderation. Speaking kindly, speaking gently. That's what all the Buddhas teach. So the Buddha is the ultimate exemplar of patience as well. But we can recollect when we do this. I mentioned Devas earlier, Deva Nusati, as one of the recollections that can be done. Also, Buddha Nusati is recollection of the Buddha. This can help to give us energy and to inspire us to practice, so we can recollect the compassion of the Buddha and the power of the Buddha to teach and give us direction in all these various ways, that we are the inheritors of this in this day and age. And we can also recollect that the changes in world history that have been affected by the Buddha. I like to think of the story of King Asoka. So, of course, this is 200, 300 years after the Buddha's already passed away. And King Asoka was known as King Asoka the Terrible. And he was reign of terror across India and was killed thousands and thousands of people. And you would think, this is somebody who was feared in the countryside and seemed to have no morality at all. And it was a conquest, a bloody conquest of terror. And because of the Buddha's teaching, he was actually able to have a complete change of heart. And we have King Asoka to thank that Buddhism is even worldwide now, based on the dissemination of the Bodhisattva by King Asoka. So the story I've heard, there's probably many, many different stories as to how he turned, but that he had learned about these monks, these Buddhist monks, and he was kind of fascinated by them, that they practiced a path of nonviolence. And of course, his path had been a path of violence. And so he sees a novice on alms round. And this novice may have been an arhant, or they may have had some sort of high meditative attainments already, but they were a young novice. And so King Asoka wanted this novice to say, come and declare to him what is the teaching of this Buddha Gotama he's been hearing about. So they invite the novice to come to this to King Asoka's royal chambers, his throne room. And then King Asoka is sitting up on his throne and he says, okay, well, what does your teacher teach? And the novice just remains silent. And he says, like, he's kind of, King Asoka's getting irritated and upset. He said, why won't you say anything? And the novice says, it's against the rules to speak Dhamma from a low seat to someone sitting on a higher seat. I'm not allowed to say anything. And oh, okay, that's King, that kind of piques his interest. That's interesting. And so, anyway, this is the story I heard. So I can't, don't, it's probably different versions, but again, I like this version. But King Asoka gets off of his throne. And, okay, can you please teach me now? And the novice gets up on the throne. And King Asoka is about to have him killed. But then the novice gives a brief teaching, and King Asoka is then it give his it gives birth to faith in his heart. And also the fact that the novice got up on the throne to teach the Dhamma, because it showed that the Dhamma is the highest, it's higher than all other things. And so that actually was it impressed it, King Asoka wanted to kill him, but it also impressed him. His audacity actually impressed him as well. So from there you have King Asoka then wanting to take on the five precepts and going all throughout India and erecting these Asokan pillars that are many of them are still standing to this day, and with Buddhist teachings written on them all over. And then it was King Asoka, one of King Asoka's daughter, one of King Asoka's daughters who became a bhikkhuni. Her name was Sanghamitta, and she's credited with disseminating Buddhism in Sri Lanka. So being on the first boat over to Sri Lanka with a cutting from the Bodhi tree to plant Buddhism in Sri Lanka. So thanks to, so the we have the Buddha. Without the Buddha, we don't have the conversion of King Asoka. Without King Asoka, we don't have worldwide Buddhism. So it's these are all these that's Buddha Nusati, just kind of that sense of, for me, it brings up a sense of awe and wonder in terms of how could, you know, how could that happen? How could that even be possible? That somebody like King Asoka, a teaching could be powerful enough to change someone who's a king who has created a reign of terror, caused them to have a complete, absolute change of heart and really become a good and upright person. And it's completely different than how they were before. And so the teaching has that power. Of course, we can reflect on that in this day and age. To affect a change like that takes another quality, and this is coming back to the quality of satta, which is normally translated as faith, but another fairly loose but possible translation of that word is courage. And courage can affect a change, even somebody, even a bad person could change to be a good person if they saw an example of courage in a person. So we can use Buddha Nusati to help us to further develop our patience, that with that sense of awe and wonder of what's possible with these types of teachings. And not to say, like, okay, well, these are good and all the other religions are bad, and we don't want to make levels in that way, but to say, well, this is what's possible. This is what's possible based on the development of these qualities. One thing Ajahn Jayasaro was teaching while he was here, and he asked me to try to talk about something, things that he didn't talk about at all, but I do want to repeat some of the stuff he said. And that was that most religions in the world are belief-based religions, and Buddhism is an education-based religion. So it's about learning about all of these qualities that we can be cultivating for ourselves. It's not about believing in the Buddha or believing in devas or believing necessarily in the teachings, but we want it stands up to scrutiny. The Dhamma teaching is to be scrutinized, and the Dhamma practices are to be tried out. See if they work, see if they work for us. So with that quality of patience, then just to end that we add kindness to that, and that can create this sense of forgiveness. In the monastery, we have a forgiveness ceremony that we do, and this ceremony comes from Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's foremost disciple in wisdom. And it happened one time that a monk was jealous of the status of Sariputta, and he went to the other monks and tried to say that Sariputta had evil desires. He's just kind of being a kissing ass kind of. I sort of sorry for my language to the Buddha, and that's why he has all his status. And at a certain point, this comes back to the Buddha, and the Buddha goes to this monk and says, like, well, let's get you and Sariputta together. Let's have a conversation. And this monk realizes, oh, what have I done? And he asks forgiveness from Sariputta. He says, okay, I made a mistake. You're not a kiss ass. He didn't, not exact words, but that's basically what he said. And Sariputta, and he so he does this forgiveness. He says, like, Acharya Pamadena Dwavratena Katang, by body, speech, or mind, these wrongs that I've done to you, I ask forgiveness. May you forgive me for them. And then Sariputta right away says, I forgive you. I never held anything against you. And then Sariputta says, and for anything I've done that was genuinely unskillful, even unintentionally, I ask forgiveness from you. So Sariputta then asks forgiveness from this monk. And the monk says, yes, I forgive you. So this ceremony that takes it takes kindness. It takes kindness from Venerable Sariputta to actually say, like, rather than just stepping aside and allowing the mind to settle in a very natural way. When we have an idea about what we want to get from the meditation, that can cause a lack of joy or keep the joy from arising. So we just had our winter retreat, and within the winter retreat, each of the monks gets 2 weeks of solitary retreat where they can be completely apart from the community for 2 weeks and just in complete solitude. Some of the monks will camp out during those times if the weather is permitting. We also do these 2 week solitary retreats in the Vasa period in the summer. We trade off doing these retreats and then can just go down, fill our bowl with food, go back up, eat at our kuti. So for me, I really cherish those times, and had an experience of one day just being at this very nice campsite. The weather was very good, weather was perfect, and just having my meal in solitude, having my meal out in the forest, and washing my bowl and having a cup of coffee, and then just setting the cup of coffee down, and then just feeling extremely content, and then was just didn't want to get up at all, and just sat there for 3 hours. And it wasn't like would think of it, but it was a lot of happiness, a lot of happiness. So having experiences like that makes me think, oh, it has to happen in a very natural way. It's not like, okay, now I'm gonna do it. Now I'm gonna focus on the breath. And that's kind of then we're in a way we're kind of blocking those experiences from it. But if we have an experience where we're able to just say, okay, wow, the mind is full of gratitude right now. Okay, let's just sit with that, and then we can experience some joy.